Okay, well, let's see. There are a number of questions dealing with the difference between Luther's relatively openness to art and worship versus Calvin's position, specifically on representing Jesus. Some of the questions challenging. Again, I was just telling you what we did at our college. It's a typical Lutheran kind of reform of a church.
Really,
so does this violate the second commandment? Is it idolatrous to use, for as Lutherans do, to use pictures of Christ in church? This is the difference between traditions. In the Reformed tradition, very little use of art in worship. The Lutheran tradition is much more open to that. But Luther would simply say that a picture, whether you agree with this or not,
this is what he would say,
a picture of Jesus is not idolatrous because Jesus is the true God. So that would be Luther's answer. He would certainly deny that this is a violation at all. Let me
go a step further. Even in the Reformed tradition, even with Zwingli
said something very interesting about art.
I didn't really cite him. And Zwingli went farther than Calvin, really, in not allowing instrumental music and not allowing a lot of other things that even Calvinists would allow.
Zwingli said that although he does not permit pictures of Jesus in church, he does not say that it's wrong to have a picture of Jesus in your home.
Okay.
And I think that's a very important distinction when you face a lot of questions about what's appropriate in church and how to use art in church or what's good here. That kind of distinction,
something can have a secular use, a picture on the wall, even a picture of Christ
at home, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to have the same kind of art in church. Now, today a lot of Christians are the other way around. They have a style of music that they really like, and they go home and they listen to that kind of music all the time. So, why can't we have it in church? I love rock. Let's have rock and roll in church. Well, we're talking about two different issues. And again, I know there are a lot of ways you can come down on that question, but the assumption that what you enjoy, in your secular, even innocent kinds of things, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have it in church.
And if you have it in church, that you have to have it, you see that distinction. And I think a lot of conflicts and controversies, that some things are appropriate in worship. There's some styles that are appropriate in worship.
And maybe other styles that are legitimate and innocent, that doesn't mean they work for worship, because of what worship is supposed to accomplish.
I tell people, the generation of the 1940s, they weren't wanting to have swing music in church. They were listening to Benny Goodman and all this. The USO, and they didn't. But then they come to church and they would sing hymns, and they didn't think that they had to have their particular style of music everywhere, because there were different functions. So sometimes it's helpful to make those kind of distinctions. The Reformed are often criticized for being anti-art, and to the point that even art history books, talking about distortions of history. You'll read that. Well, the Calvinists, of course, had no impact on art. And the Calvinists, even I read a book on the Dutch masters. And they said, well, of course, you can't say they're very religious, but you can't say their religion influenced their art, because, as we know, Calvinism rejected art. And again, it's just circular. What they were making that same mistake in another direction. They didn't use art in church. Therefore, they must have been against art. Well, it wasn't true. But each thing has to have its appropriate realm. So anyway, again, I thanks for playing Mighty Fortress for us Lutherans. I'm not trying to make you into Lutheran. Look at all the good things I'm saying about Calvin. So you'll still find lots in Lutheranism to criticize, I'm sure. But again, at least in our minds, we're certainly not committing idolatry because Jesus is the true God. The other question, you need to answer these one after the other. If the experience of beauty is to involve joy and love of the object, what about art intended to evoke the opposite emotion, such as disgust? For instance, a disillusioned post-World War I artist who depicted the horrors of war or an artist attempting to convey the ugliness of death. Thus, does all art has to convey beauty? Well, it's a very good question. First of all, there are two different things, two different kinds of art suggested here. Postmodern art, much of it rejects beauty, rejects the concept of beauty, and tries to instead say that anything that creates a reaction in the audience, that's a mistake experience. So you have art today made of cut-up bodies, taking cadavers, other human beings, and carving them into funny positions and portraying that. And it's designed to its purpose is to disgust. And again, I reject art like that. It's anti-art. That kind of art is not, you know, for glory or beauty. It's art that's against art and against all the purpose of art. However, there is art that does produce or depict and express despair and, you know, the horrors of war. Certainly post-World War I artists referred here, artists attempting to convey the ugliness of death. I contend that that does create or can provoke love, because what it produces in you is compassion. When an artist expresses his despair, the proper response to that is compassion for the artist who's in that horrible condition. The horrors of war, it produces pity at the deaths and the destruction and the horrors of human sin. Now, that is love, a type of love that's produced by the object. Okay. Is it joy? Well, not exactly, but I think there is a kind of joy that comes from tragedy. Again, tragedy that talks about the catharsis that comes from pity and fear. And the pity that the compassion is so powerful, and the fear that this could be us. It's a very powerful effect, but it's cathartic, which is another word for cleansing, in the sense that that kind of experience is good for a person, and it's a good aesthetic experience. So, does all art have to convey beauty? Well, what I'm doing, I'm just defining beauty more broadly. Beauty, all art doesn't have to be pretty. An art can be tragic, but there properly a beauty in that. And the idea of love, I think, is especially provoked by, you know, images of suffering and compassion. So, last one here. How does the Hudson River School's method of depth, expanse, and the smallness of man in God's creation coincide with man's dominical nature? Okay, the idea that man has been given dominion over the world. Certainly the Hudson River artists painted different things than just landscapes, with tiny little people. And, when you're trying to see how somebody thinks, you don't just look at one sentence in the book. You have to look at the whole thing. I think in these works, they are portraying the grandeur of God, the majesty of God is expressed in his works, and also a kind of rebuke at the time for humanism, specifically Romanticism. A lot of the Hudson River artists and their books I was reading, you know, they're writing a time of Romanticism where the self is everything. The subjectivity and the human self, whatever fulfills the self, on and on and on. And they just rip that apart. Say, no, an artist has to get rid of the self so that God's creation can shine through. So they were thinking in those terms, and that was the point they were making. I think the best image of the dominion that God has given us in these paintings is the painting themselves, the paintings themselves. We have an artist taking in this vision and able to paint it so with such fidelity and such control. To me, that's the best image of the dominion. One more thing, a question that it wasn't written down, but someone raised it later, and it's really important because I don't want you to get the wrong impression. On vocation, someone pointed out that Michael Jordan got cut from his basketball team at one point in his career. And he could have said, well, I guess I'm a failure, so that must not be my calling. You know, remember, I think I overstated, you know, if you fail, if you flunk out all your courses in your major, maybe that's not your calling. Failure can be a trial, remember? The other thing I said, a trial, trials of testing. Michael Jordan maybe needed to face some of those failures to really become the kind of player he became. I'm pretty sure that basketball is his true was his true vocation, and it can be a failure of vocation. If you fail your courses, maybe the problem you really want to be an accountant and you fail all your business courses. Maybe the problem is it's not your accounting vocation, it's your vocation as a student that is wanting. In other words, maybe you're not studying. Okay, maybe there are reasons like that that you're flunking your courses. And the answer to that is not give up, but maybe to straighten yourself out and do better. And I think if you have, and again, all the things about Luther talking about the trials and tribulations and temptation, the devil wanting to get you out of your vocation, you know, these are reasons not to just quit. If you have that conviction and that desire and those talents, you know, those may well be signs of what you're being called to. And you may have failures along the way, but if you're like Michael Jordan, you're not going to let those stop you. And the same is true in other vocations. So that's part of the struggle by which we grow. So I want to make sure that you understand that. I think if you want to be an accountant, but it's against your nature, or you want to be a basketball player, but it's against your nature, or you're trying to do something that you hate and that you're bored with and that you don't have that drive, then yeah, that's probably your vocation. I mean, that's probably not your vocation, even though maybe it is. So although, you know, God does sometimes ask things that are hard for us, and our vocations may be very hard. Anyway, I wanted to make that clear. So
Thank you. I have a really surprising question. Can you give us some of the why reasons for modesty? Has the modesty issue been beaten to death yet this week? It's interesting. I was supposed to have this last night, and I had my whole answer figured out, and we didn't have time. And Rich and I are driving home in the car, can you imagine Rich and I ever disagreeing on something? Can you imagine Rich how being just like this real calm person that never has an opinion on anything? Mm-hmm. By the time I was done with it, I'm like, oh man, I'm glad I didn't say anything. Rich just sort of like blew me out of the water. But anyway, so now as I've rethought it again, I'm going to give you a composite view of sort of what I was thinking and what Rich was thinking. Because I think that maybe hearing it coming in from two angles might help you catch what's really at stake here. when we deal with modesty, one thing that struck me was that there is, again, this covenantal responsibility that's coming up. Covenantal responsibility in the sense that we live in community, therefore we need to be responsible one to another. And you get principles like in 1 Corinthians 8 where it talks about weaker brethren with the meat issue. And those kinds of principles may apply, therefore, into how we dress, thinking about weaker brethren and those issues. Second angle that hit me was the whole role of maybe the father in the family, where it is the father's responsibility to raise his children in righteousness, and it is the father's responsibility, therefore, to give instruction on certain issues and to protect his family. So a father may be wishing to protect his daughter by telling her, you're not going out of the house this way, you know, that way. And it may feel like he's just being mean, but it's very valid for him to be concerned about how his children dress in the context of what kind of people that might be attracting. You know, we've made this comment, you made the comment, I think, last night about a righteous man doesn't want to whisper in his girlfriend's ear and get an echo. Okay, remember that?
No.
But the point is that the same thing is true, that, you know, a girl that might dress in a provocative way, she's sending a message out to men that I'm easy, you can take me. Okay, and so the father may say it wants to protect his daughter from being lure to that kind of person, and so he may say, you're not going to dress that way. And he may have certain standards that he thinks right because he's a man and he sort of knows what men look at. Okay? Now, we still haven't solved the problem yet. Because the next thing is, who sets who decides how long your dress is supposed to be, or your, you know, whether it goes over your shirt goes over your shoulder or whatever. And maybe your dad has one standard and all of a sudden a different standard got put in here. Okay? And so it's like, well, why is it wrong for me to wear such and such? I wear it all the time, or whatever. And that then becomes the issue of, again, a covenantal issue of responsibility to leadership. But now this is where Rich just blew me out of the water, though. He said, and this is what I think is very important, he said, this modesty thing bugs me because we're treating the girls like they somehow have to take care of the men's sin problem. Okay? Now, all right, now wait a second. I think that's a significant issue, because what Rich is saying to us is, it's the guys that are going to take what they look at and use it for evil. And he says, and why are we putting it on the girls to take the responsibility for someone else's sin? And there's a dynamic to that I think is absolutely right. It's the guy that's going to do the sinning, okay? It's the guy that's taking the information that he gets. Now, my argument with Rich was, well, Rich, it's a lot easier for me to lust after a girl if she's dressed provocatively or less clothing than if she's dressed covered. And Rich is like, well, maybe that's true for you, but I know men, and it doesn't make any difference how much clothing the girl has on or the guy has on. They will still lust. And he's right. So that in a way, the modesty issue becomes not a way of solving the problem here. You could be clad from your neck to your toes. I think we were talking about this at lunch with someone. And how you could still be an object of lust. What Rich said to me, and this is what just hit me really profoundly, and that's why I want to share where he's coming from, because I think it really gets to the issue. He said, the two people can wear the exact same outfit, buttoned exactly the same way, and one can be modest, and one can be provocative. He said, it is the heart. And he's right. I mean, your dad can tell you, and we can tell you, and I can tell you that if you wear a certain kind of clothing, it's more seductive to a man and more on you and all that. But you know, it's your heart. Because you can wear a frumpy sweatshirt and loose jeans and the whole deal, and you can still be provocative. Because it's the heart. What's your heart doing with it? So what's your heart doing? And when you get dressed, and I gave the girls the benefit of the doubt. I'm saying a lot of you don't know what you do when you get dressed. I'm like, they don't realize what they're doing to the guys. Rich is like, oh, right. Okay? He's brutal because he's, and I think Rich is right. He says, you do know what you're doing. okay? And so you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, why am I wearing this particular top? Because it fits down to the line exactly what I was told by the counselor. It's exactly long enough. It's exactly cut right. But I know it's seductive. Why are you going to wear it? Why are you going to go just to the edge of the line, do exactly what you're told, but still figure out a way to be seductive? Because you want to be seductive. You want to buy into the world's view that your body's your value, and you want to seduce the guys and get some kind of head trip because guys notice you, and that makes you feel more valuable because two guys noticed me today, okay? And so you got to really check your heart on the modesty issue. Why are you responding this way? And then, see, we're not done. This is what really blew me out of the water. Rich said, how comes only the girls have to be modest? And I'm like, what? He said, did you see the football game? Did you see the football game? He said, did you notice a lot of the guys had their shirts off? And I said, yeah, I noticed. I thought it was like a skins and shirts game until I realized, no, it wasn't. It was just sort of random. He said, no, it wasn't random. So the guys that had their shirts off had good chests, didn't they? Okay? He said, the guys that didn't have their shirts off probably didn't and didn't want to show their chests because, like me, they have nothing and are embarrassed about it. Okay? So what Rich said is, What do the guys running around without their shirts off do? They're strutting. They're actually showing off to the girls, or they're showing off to one another. And how do we know that there aren't people here that have same-sex attraction problems, struggles, who are also being brought into sin by that? Okay? So Rich said, we got a double standard. It's the heart, folks. So the guys, you need to ask yourselves just as hard as the girls have to ask themselves. Why do I dress the way I dress, and why do I act the way I act? It's the heart lived within community under authority. See how I got both back together? A heart living in community under authority. Doesn't matter ultimately the length of your skirt if you're not caring about the other person. Yeah. Very
good. Yeah, amen. I want to add to what David said just by reminding you that it is true that men, I think, need to be careful as well, especially when you got... I've never had to be careful, but some people do. But... the fact doesn't need to be ignored that God gives a specific command to women. The Bible says that women are to adorn themselves with modest apparel, with propriety and moderation. And then it includes the very thing that Pastor Longacre just pointed out. And he says, not in a certain way, with braided hair, gold, pearls, costly clothing, provocative stuff, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. So it's not just the clothes, it's the heart attitude. It is, in fact, the case that you could wear a croaker sack with a paper bag on your head and still be seductive. I didn't say it was easy. And I had this, you have epiphanies sometimes that are too late. And as Dr. Veith was talking, I thought, I got cut from a basketball team. Oh, no. I read entirely too much from that into that, I think. Okay. How do you answer unbelievers who are convinced that Christianity is spread mostly through raping, pillaging, and bloodshed, even when they can't present facts and still insist they're right? What do you say? I say they're ignoramuses. That's just silly. The difference in the other question is related. That is, what would you say to someone if while you're comparing Islam and Christianity, they try to throw in your face that in the Old Testament, God commanded Israelites to destroy entire cities? That's right. And that was quite exceptional, wasn't it? That's not the way we go about things. That's not normative. It is exceptional. And he did it to the Canaanites, and and allowed it and allows it to happen to people who do great damage and harm, so that the Canaanites offering child sacrifice, human sacrifice, rebelling against God after many, many years of testimony and God bearing with them and bearing with them and sending prophets into their midst. Yes, eventually he is a just God and he brings capital punishment sometimes on whole cultures and peoples. And that's what happened. That is exceptional. What is the norm for Christianity? How does Christianity spread normally according to the commandments of God? By love, by profession, by professing faith. That's exception. But you see, turn it around and read the Quran. And I don't have my quotes. I had a whole long list of quotes too from the Quran. But it is clear that it is normative to kill. It is normative. Jihad is unending. That's not an exception. Jihad is ongoing and never ceases. And you talk, you listen to some of these fellows. They call them fundamentalists. Well, remember how the modern world uses that term. The fundamentalist is someone who takes his sacred book seriously and follows it. Mm-hmm. The fundamentalists are the serious Muslims. The other Muslims are liberals, neo-orthodox. They don't take it seriously. They read it and they go, oh, come on, there are thousands of ways to reinterpret that. That doesn't mean anything. Fundamentalists take the Word of God as the Word of God. So these guys are taking the Quran seriously, and Osama believes that he can kill you at any hour of the day and be doing Allah's service. There's a vast, vast difference. This is unspeakably ignorant and naive. And let's kindly tell them that they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, a couple more questions. Okay, when trying to discern the world views represented by Autumn on the Hudson and Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, remember that was the one by Gainsborough, I believe, with the 18th century, you know, family looking over their estate. Could not one easily confuse the former as naturalistic and the latter as showing man exercising dominion? How can one studying art discern worldviews from the paintings alone? Okay, excellent question. Okay, first of all, you can't discern worldviews, I think, from the paintings alone, or very seldom can. You need to put them in their intellectual and spiritual and historic context in terms of what the author was believing and expressing. Now, having said that, Autumn of the Hudson, I mean, that's very different from naturalism, which would come in the late 19th century. Naturalism was the view of Darwin. You know, nature is all there is. Material, that's all. Nature is red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson said. So you find in the naturalist a very brutal view of nature. The romantics at least glorified nature. No, isn't nature wonderful? The naturalist says, no, it isn't. The law of nature is survival of the fittest, the strong kill the weak, and that's all there is. So there's a kind of a hardness in a naturalistic painting and a really hatred of nature. Quite correctly, because they see it as something very bleak and empty. Whereas the Hudson River School, you have that transcendence. In other words, the eye doesn't stop with nature. If you look at Hudson River School, the eye is drawn further and further back into the light. You're sort of looking through nature to what lies beyond nature. So you'd never get the idea that nature is all there is. Or that, you know, this is ultimate. But it's true. To really do worldview criticism, you have to know the context. Now, this raises another question, though. Looking at art as a Christian, okay, looking at art through Christian eyes, we will see other things. Now, you can see Mr. and Mrs. Andrews and know that this is of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, sort of a humanistic time. And yet from Christian eyes, we can see some value in that. That speaks to us of man's dominion over nature. Okay. Now that's not exactly what the artist maybe was expressing, but to us, we can see through our own, you know, theological, spiritual categories and see something of value, even in a work, you know, from the Enlightenment period. The same way, we can look at a impressionist painting, and again, you don't have to buy into the whole worldview of the impressionists that tended to look at everything just from the physiology of the eyeball, how light plays on the eyeball, and that, but for us, we see, you know, glory and beauty because we see the bigger picture. And so we're not limited just
to heaven. Not that there's going to be some sign in the sky that everybody's going to see, but rather this is going to happen as a sign that the Son of Man is exalted to the right hand of the Father. In other words, the language of Daniel 7, the Son of Man ascended up to the Ancient of Days, judgment is going to be poured out and the kingdom is established in the earth. All of that is behind Matthew 24 and the book of Revelation. And so when you read those what were prophetic passages when they gave them, they're not talking about things in the far distant future. This is very common judgment language, and it's being applied to Israel. Israel in the short term. Israel's going to be destroyed in these last days.
Okay, there's a question on vocation. You stated that vocation is loving your neighbor. Is this not a rather meaningless distinction, since Jesus says to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself? What biblical basis do you have to make such a distinction? Okay, I don't think I understand. I don't understand the question. Okay, first of all, vocation, the purpose of vocation, according to the theologians who wrote about it, is to carry out love of your neighbor. The distinction, I'm not sure what distinction I made, but the text talks about loving the Lord, your God, with all your heart, your soul, your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So those are the two greatest commandments. So we have a relationship with God, and we're to love Him with everything that's in us, and we're to love our neighbor just as we love ourselves. So the distinction, I mean, obviously those go together for a Christian. You can't really love your neighbor as God wants unless we've been, you know, transformed by the gospel. But we love God, and then we're to love our neighbors. You know, what can we do for God? God does everything for us. Well, what God asks of us is that we love our neighbors. And we do that in everyday life, everyday relationship, in our various vocations. So, again, I'm probably missing something in the question, but that's as good as I can do.
Well, let's answer this one together, shall we? Pastor Wilkins, why do you not want applause during the evening service, which resembles a church service? Actually, that's not my rule. I'm in favor of the rule, but I much prefer a much more tangible and profitable way of showing your appreciation. Anybody can applaud, you know, but if you really mean it, you'll...
Oh, man.
Wait a minute!
Well, that didn't hurt.
Well, all right.
Yeah, throw paper, it's softer. That's what Jesus said.
All right. Nobody moves. All of this is ours. Man, how much did we get here? Okay.
A lot of it's just nickel.
This is getting to be insult.
Oh!
Hey, now we're talking. Now we're doing something here. Oh.
Anyway.
even, you know, I can tell the sarcasm in all of this. I want you to know. It doesn't test me down. Good miss. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to start something here. Okay. All right. Enough horsing around now. In the Psalms of David encourages us to clap, sing, and dance before the Lord. What is the reasoning in your belief? Well, we have in this culture think clapping and singing of David is talking about. He's talking about praising God and clapping your hands like the trees wave and all the rest. And it is one thing to rejoice before the Lord. But you see, applause is one of the ways in our particular culture you show your appreciation. Very often, that is, usually that's restricted to performances. Mm-hmm. Now, in worship, we're not performing. The preacher isn't performing for you. Mm-hmm. Christ is speaking to you, and I think you should give thanks to God. And the way you do that is offering up the sacrifice of praise, the fruit of the lips. Giving thanks to his name. Applause in worship is inappropriate because it implies that worship is just another performance. So that when people sing for us in worship, we now hear Christian churches and Reformed and Presbyterian churches, I hear, even applaud now. I think that's way out of line. This is not a concert. It is worship. And we shouldn't applaud in worship as if it's a concert or some form of entertainment. We're worshiping God. God is coming to serve us. We're serving Him. And that's the point of that. So this cultural expression of applause, I think we understand the context of that. And in the lectures, we understand the context of that. And we appreciate your kindness because I know what you're saying. And it's a kind thing. And we do appreciate it. But you see, we need to give thanks to God. And in worship, you do that in a different way because worship is not a performance. Even though we've had some rather entertaining lectures, and I thought, but that's not those were not performances, though it was an effort to help. So anyway, there's a different context. Some things are appropriate. It's just like Dr. Veith was saying a while ago about music. There's some music that's appropriate in certain settings that would be utterly inappropriate in other settings. I mean, Who Let the Dogs Out may be okay when Alabama wins. Especially when they play Tennessee. But that would not be appropriate at a funeral. Right? If you did that at a funeral, everybody would go, "Do you have no sensibilities? You're an ignoramus. What's wrong with you? That's nuts." You see, some things are appropriate. Shorts are appropriate here, but if you go to a wedding dressed like this, you would think, "I'm showing disrespect for the event. It's an important event." Mm-hmm. And so you dress differently, you do things differently, as appropriate for the occasion. One of the things we have lost in our culture is a sense of what the old word solemn, which is a solemn, glorious, joyful, celebratory event in which people dress up to show their joy. They're not showing off, they're showing their joy and their thankfulness for the glory of the occasion. And people used to have that attitude toward worship, which is why you wore your Sunday best. That is, the clothes that, not that they were the most formal clothes or the most elaborate clothes, but they were clothes that you preserved for that activity. You didn't wear normal clothes in worship. And there was a reason for that. You're coming before God, and you want to wear clothes appropriate to the occasion. If you go to the White House, you don't go in a T-shirt. See, If I go, I won't go like this. I'll dress appropriately because I want to show respect for the office and for where I am. And what we are seeing today is that nobody cares about anybody but their own comfort. So if my T-shirt's comfortable, I'll wear it to worship. And who are you to get in my face about my T-shirt? It's clean, doesn't stink. Well, we're losing we're losing a lot here, because in worship you're ascending up into heaven and gathering around the throne with a multitude of spirits made perfect and the holy angels. That's where you're going in worship. If we physically went there, I suspect we would dress differently. It's very important how you dress, how do you carry yourself, what you do. And we've got to learn again how to live like a Christian people who recognize distinctions of events and offices and things like that.